All right. Now, granted, we're dealing with the Psalm of David. So this is written 1,000 years before the New Testament era. David traditionally came to the throne almost exactly 1,000 B.C. Give or take a couple of years, there's some, you know, chronology issues, but only a difference of a few years. And yet the concept of what is described here in verse 18 was fairly standard, although the Romans, I suppose, perfected it. Sam, you'd be able to help me out with this. In the Soviet era, in the Soviet Union, 1st of May, May Day. All right. And how did they celebrate May Day in Moscow?
Take all their military might and put it on display.
Okay. Big parades full of tanks and transports and all this other stuff, missiles on trailers and all this other stuff to show their power and their might. In ancient times, if a king came back from a campaign, whether he was victorious or not, but especially if he was victorious, there would be the procession. And by the way, at the close of the Civil War, they did this in Washington, D.C., a huge procession of all these people going by the Capitol building and so forth. We've done this today. They do this. Processions. Did this following World War II. I don't know if we've done it a whole lot since because there's such a schism in the country. But processions of the military coming through. The soldiers coming home to honor and accolades and so forth. And in ancient times, they would not just have the parade of the honorable officers going through on horseback, instead of waving in the back of a convertible, but on horseback in their full regalia with the sword and all this stuff, and then the soldiers marching in procession behind them, and then they would have on the tail end of this the loot. They would have, and if you go to, there's a column in Rome, and it's sort of a spiral embossed thing where they've cut into it the victory, which is what it was, what is it called, of the destruction of Jerusalem. And that's one of the reasons why we know exactly what the candelabra looked like that was in the holy place. Because it is etched into this column. And so they have all the loot, or a bunch of, and in the actual parade, they would have a whole lot more than they actually etched into the stone. All the stuff that they brought, the gold, the furnishings, all this beautiful stuff that they are bringing home from the victory. And then they would have a parade afterward, a short parade, of the prisoners. Now, in Roman times, the prisoners, for the most part, were destined for the arena. But during the time of David, depending on what empire you're talking about, some of them would be enslaved. Some of them would be held how did they do this? What's the word I'm looking for? They would be held as captives, unable to go home to make sure the folks back would obey. Because you mess up. Your kids are over here, and you better stay straight, otherwise something might happen to your kids. That was common practice. And so you would, as it says here in verse 18, thou hast ascended on high, you have ascended to that elevated position. If you walked into a throne room, even today, and everybody's, let's just say for the sake of argument, everybody could sit down. Who is the tallest in the room as far as looking at the heads? The king, the monarch, because their seat is elevated. So much so that in most cases, if everybody were standing and he's sitting down, he's still the tallest. He is elevated. It's a place of honor. You don't want somebody higher than you. This is one of the reasons why in dictatorships and so on, the leaders portrait has to be high enough on the wall so that his head is above the heads of the people there. If you ever go into a government building and they have a picture of the president, the vice president, who is always higher on the wall? The president. All right. So he has ascended on high. Thou hast led captivity captive. You have brought in your procession of your captives in that victory parade. And that's what it's alluding to there in verse 18. Thou hast received gifts of men. If you go through the books of, especially of Kings, you see a little bit of this in 2 Samuel as well, where if the monarch is powerful, even if he hasn't gone to war with a particular nation, a particular neighbor, whatever the case may be, it was not unusual for somebody who was powerful that a neighboring kingdom, or maybe even not so close, would send a delegation to visit the king and would pay honor to him by giving him a bunch of gifts. Now, practically speaking, why would they do that? Why would, for example, David, King David, defeated the Arameans that were in northern Syria, and a kingdom north of there brought gifts down to David, in part in thanks because that kingdom that he had defeated had also been warring against them, so they took out the bad guys as far as they were concerned. Why else would they do this, practically speaking?
Get on the good side of
it. Yeah! Alright. He's evidently very powerful. It's always good to have powerful friends, not powerful enemies. And we want to make sure that he doesn't cast his eyes in our direction as perhaps somebody to incorporate into his empire. And therefore, we want to be an ally. We want him to be a friend. We want to have good relations with these folks. And so they would bring gifts. They are paying homage to him. Thus receive gifts of men. Yea, for the rebellious also. And then that last line, that the Lord might dwell among them. So, by necessity, with that line alone, we are not dealing with David, we are dealing with a millennial kingdom circumstance. Because that's exactly what's going to happen. The Lord will be the king. Jesus is the king that will reign forever and ever. He is the heir to the throne of David. No one sits on the throne of David is an earthly throne. The notion that when Jesus ascended on high and he sat down at the right hand of the Father, that he's sitting on the throne of David is nonsense. David never ruled in heaven. David ruled on earth. The throne of David right now is unoccupied. It is not but an empty seat sitting in Jerusalem, by the way. It's the idea of an earthly king ruling over Israel, who is of the right lineage, of the right pedigree. This is why we have, again, the genealogy in Matthew 1, that Jesus is the heir to the throne of David, physically, as well as spiritually. So what we have there in verse 18 is dealing with the Lord's millennial reign. He has gained victory, Revelation 19, and a whole host of other places in the scripture. It's kind of interesting. You could piece together some things from Daniel chapter 12 that there's going from the between the time the Lord comes and until the time that the kingdom is actually in place and running. There's a little gap. It's only like a month, but there's a gap. And when the Lord returns, he has to defeat his enemies. And then you have the rebuilding process. And then you have the kingdom established. And so, what you have there in verse 18 is sort of the inauguration, the procession, the honor that is paid to the ascended king. All right, any further questions on verse 18? All right, next page. This is going to expand on this a little bit more. The Lord is the victor. In verse 19, blessed be the Lord. And here's a translation issue. This is not a text issue. This is a translation issue. Look in verse, and it really doesn't matter that much because both of them are good. Verse 19, blessed be the Lord who daily, and it says in the King James, loadeth us with benefits. even the God of our salvation. Now, you'll notice that there's a bunch of italicized words in there, which means that those were put in by the translator to make it better reading English. When you in your King James, in your New King James, and in your New American Standard, and also the American Standard 1901, if somebody happens to have one of those, you'll have italicized words in your text. And those are words that were supplied by the translators to make it easy reading in English, or sometimes explanatory, because some things are left out in the original text and you have to sort of piece it together. And so they supply those words. This is one of the reasons why I don't like a lot of some of the newest translations, the freer translations, because they don't have that. And you don't know what's in the original text and what isn't. I much prefer a literal translation that deals with the Greek and Hebrew a little more, I don't know, I suppose, specifically. So it says, "Blessed be the Lord who daily loadeth us with benefits." Now, that's true. God loads us with benefits. We could spend hours going through all the things that the Lord has provided for us. It's just amazing what the Lord provides for us. So many things that we take for granted, virtually everything we take for granted is a gift from God. But the text conveys, I think, a different idea. And the idea, rather, is that He bears our loads. He bears our loads. And I want you to go to Galatians chapter 6. In Galatians chapter 6, it says, "Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual..." Now, we got to be careful with that, because some people think, "I am spiritual, I am qualified for this." And it's kind of like when you think you've mastered humility, you've lost it. I had a friend in college who went to camp, and he was very helpful and condescending and everything, in a nice way, while he was there at camp helping other campers and so on. And at the end of the week, they gave him an award for humility. And the irony of it, he says, "Hey, I'm humble. I got an award to prove it." But if a man be overtaken in a fault, you which are spiritual. In other words, those of you who have your act together, those of you who are following the Lord, those of you who are not living a life of rebellion, restore such a one. It says, in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted. Verse 2 is the thing I wanted to focus on. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. For if a man think himself to be something, when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself. But let every man prove his own work, and then he shall have rejoicing in himself alone and not another. For every man shall bear his own burden. Now, verse 2 and verse 5 seem to be in conflict. Verse 2, it says, "Bear ye one another's burdens." And in verse 5, it says, "For a man shall bear his own burden." And we have I'm going to come back. This is going to tie in with what we're looking at in the Psalm. The word burden is a different word in the Greek in those locations. This is one of those... You have good English translations. You don't need to be a linguistic scholar to understand and study the Bible. There's a few places where it's helpful, and this is also one of the reasons why I recommend a study Bible, because if you've got a lot of the study Bibles, will have a little note telling you about this stuff, so you don't need me up here to tell you. Burden, two different words. The first one, verse 2, "Bear ye one another's burdens." This is the kind of burden that the Lord would bear for us, and more so. This is something that is crushing, that is something that is just beyond our ability to deal with on our own. I use the illustration, you know, I covered this when we were in the other building. When we were downtown, the piano was great. They've got it in storage here somewhere. It was a, 8 or 9 foot grand. It was huge. It was an old Chickering, which was the premier piano before Steinway. It's a great piano. And, my wife liked it better than the Steinway they got to replace it with. And the touch and everything. It's just nice piano. And I would say, "All right, Samantha," and who was, you know, 6 or whatever at the time, would you pick that piano up and take it over here for me?" It's like, "Dad." Right. Can't do that. As a matter of fact, when we rolled that, had the roller things, even when we rolled that, it took like 6 guys to do it. I didn't want to think about trying to lift that up onto the platform. It's a crushing burden. It is something that would be incomprehensible for I suppose there probably is somebody on earth that could do this, but position themselves underneath there and sort of carry this thing gently down and set it down. I suppose there's people on earth that could do that. I'm not one of them. I don't know anybody that is. It's a crushing burden. It's something we cannot bear ourselves. And that's why it says in verse 2 there, to bear one another's burdens. People need help. People need encouragement. There's things that people can't do by themselves. This is one of the reasons why Grace Baptist Church, at least in the past, it's been a little while since we've had it, but there was a window of time where we could probably had our own moving company. We got so good at moving people to a different apartment or to a house or whatever the case may be. Because, you know, it's a little difficult to take all your furniture out of one house and put it into another by yourself. Some things are too heavy. It's just too much. And you need help. There's things that we're dealing with on a personal level that, just the emotion is overwhelming. We need somebody to come alongside and comfort us. And when it comes to the burden of sin, this is something that we cannot do ourselves. God must do it for us. And so He bears our burden for us. It's something that is beyond us. And that's the idea there in verse 2. By the way, the one in verse 5, the word there is used for a soldier's pack, a ship's cargo, that sort of thing. It's something that is your responsibility. You could take that word burden and I suppose put in the word responsibility. It conveys the same idea. Every man shall bear his own responsibility. We are not utterly and completely passive. God has given us responsibilities that we are to fulfill. He empowers us to do it. But I can't, when I say, would you pray for me? That doesn't mean, okay, great, I don't have to pray anymore. I got somebody else gonna do it for me. That's not the idea. I still have that responsibility to pray. I still have that responsibility to read and study my Bible on my own. I still have that responsibility to fulfill my Christian responsibilities. The burdens that God has put on me as an individual, I have to fulfill. I need to do those things. I can't pass them on to somebody else. Some things I can. There's a number of things. They are mine, and I cannot give them to somebody else. And that's what it says there in verse 5. Every man shall bear his own burden. All right, back to Psalm 68. And the idea there of the Lord, by the way, in verse 19, dealing with our sin burden and so on, is tied in there with the last phrase, even the God of our salvation. Now, salvation, when you read that word in the Old Testament, and once in a great while in the New, salvation, we have a tendency, rightly so, to think of the idea of our eternal salvation. When you're reading the Psalms of David in particular, probably half the time or more, he is referencing a temporal salvation. God has delivered. I had an invading force was coming into my kingdom, and God saved us. He is the God of our salvation. He's the God of our salvation as far as eternity is concerned. He is the God of our salvation as far as thwarting this invading army. That God turned them back, or He intervened in some way, or He gave us victory over them under impossible odds. God is the God of our salvation. But I think here in verse 19 that the idea is primarily eternal, based on the greater context here. Verse 20. He that is our God is the God of salvation. And unto God, the Lord, belong the issues from death. God delivers. He is the God of our salvation who delivers us from death temporally. He is the God who delivers us from death eternally. Verse 21. Tying back into it, because he goes back and forth. You'll see this in a lot of the Psalms. Whether we're dealing with eternal salvation or temporal salvation, verse 21, because they're related. One is an object, is a lesson of the other, or an illustration. Verse 21. But God shall wound the head of his enemies and the hairy scalp of such a one as goeth on still in his trespasses. There's not enough context to know whether we're dealing with millennial or the time of David. Let's expand on this a little bit. We'll go down to verse 22. The Lord said, I will bring again from Bashan, and I will bring my people again from the depths of the sea. A defeat of enemies in verse 21. I'm more inclined to think that this is millennial because of what is said hereafter. Verse 20, 22. The Lord said, I will bring again from Bashan. I will bring, notice that it says, my people is in italics. So it isn't necessarily in reference to Israel. I think it's in reference to the folks there in verse 21. I will bring again from the depths of the sea, that thy foot may be dipped in the blood of thine enemies and the tongue of the dogs in the same. Gruesome. We have several places in the Bible where it talks about the Lord's return. We also have some other places dealing with future battles. And people descend on Jerusalem thinking, we've got this in hand. It is, we have an overwhelming force. We are going to be victorious. And then all of a sudden something happens. The Lord intervenes. And they are fleeing for their lives. Now, in Israel, because of the lay of the land, because of a number of other things, if you come in with a force of people, doesn't matter whether they're on wheels or on foot or on horses. Doesn't make any difference. Let's say for the sake of argument that we're dealing with on foot. By the way, the future invasions are probably going to be, by and large, on foot. There might be transports and so on, but it's going to be mostly on foot. If people get into the land, into Israel, geographic Israel, and all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, I got to get out of here. How do you get out of there? What are your routes? How can you get out of Israel? This is one of the neat places about that piece of real estate. It's sort of the intersection of the world. How do you get out of there?
Downhill of the ocean?
All right. If you're going to the west, you got the Mediterranean. And so you can do a Dunkirk kind of thing. They all go down and they get in ships and off they go. If you go east, you're not going to get real far because then you end up in this huge expanse of hundreds of miles of flat desert with absolutely no water and you will perish. There's no obstructions or anything. It's just, you know, when it's 110 degrees and there's no water and it doesn't work. If you go south, you run into more desert and eventually go into Egypt if you turn right on your way. Your only other option is north. Invaders, by the way, historically have always come into Israel from the north. This is why when you read the prophets and it talks about it'll talk about the north because that's the route the invaders took because that was the only place you could come where it wasn't land route that wasn't desert. And so they would come in from the north. So if they're fleeing, they're going to go either by sea or they're going to go north. All right. I will bring again from Bashan. Where is Bashan? I think I alluded to this last time. Where's Bashan?
To the north.
To the north. We would call Bashan today. I probably didn't spell this right. Did I? Okay. Golan Heights. All right. So north and a little bit east of the Sea of Galilee. Piece of real estate the Israelis took from the Syrians in 67. And they're still hanging on to it. It's kind of interesting. They gave back the Sinai. They gave back the Gaza. They're holding on to the West Bank. They're holding on to Golan Heights, and there's reasons for that. So they're fleeing. They're heading to the north. And by the way, we don't know who the enemy is. It doesn't give a name. And they can't escape. I will bring again from Bashan. I will bring again from the depths of the sea. To what end? That the enemies may be destroyed. That thy foot may be dipped in the blood of thine enemies, and the tongue of the dogs, of thy dogs in the same. The Israelites did not keep dogs. You had dogs that hung around the villages and cities eating scraps and garbage and that kind of thing. If you were a practicing Jew, Old Testament, which was for the most part, even when they were in rebellion, they still honored the Sabbath and kind of, it's just ironic how people do this. But let's say, what was the mode, primary, other than these things, what was the mode of transportation in ancient times? Primary.
Donkey.
Donkey. All right. Is a donkey kosher? No, a donkey's not kosher. Doesn't part a hoof, doesn't chew a cud. So, you know, everybody had a donkey in their garage. And, you know, they're only good for so many years. And so what happens when your donkey named Chevy, finally bites the dust? What do you do with it? Burying it requires a lot of effort. That's time and effort and all that other stuff. You know, if I just, you know, hook up another donkey to him, get my tow donkey, and hook it over to my old one that's dead, and haul it down to the dump, and then I just leave it there. This is a buffet for the dogs. All right. And that's what the dogs in ancient Israel did. They were carrion eaters. They were like jackals. And so they lived on that kind of thing. When Jehu, overthrew the king and, came to Jezreel, there were two capitals. They had a summer palace and a winter palace based on elevation. So he comes to Jezreel. And this nasty woman found out what was going on, and she put all of her makeup on, and then she stuck her head out the window and said, "Did Zimri have peace who slew his master?" This was Jezebel, the queen mother. And Jehu looks up, she was sticking her head out of a second or third story window, and he said, "Who's on my side?" And a couple of eunuchs stuck their heads out the window, he says, "Throw her down." And as my pastor told me years ago, he was preaching this, and it was totally out of character for him. He says, they grabbed her by the arms and legs and whoosh, threw her out the window, and down she came and splattered all over the place like a ripe watermelon. And then Jehu ran his chariot back and forth across her a few times. And then he went inside and had lunch. And while he was eating lunch, he says, "Hey, go bury that woman because she was a princess." And they go out. And they came back in and said, all we found was palms of her hands, her feet, and her head, her skull. And he says, this fulfilled the word of the Lord from Elijah. He says, the dogs will eat Jezebel by the ramparts of Jezreel. And they did. And so that's the idea there, that the vanquished. We don't do this in the West. But, you know, when you had the Iran-Iraq war, remember that one way, way back? There were bodies all over the desert, and the vultures had a feast. They just left them there. It's too much trouble to go out and deal with that. They just left them there. And so that's the idea being conveyed there in verse 23. We are over time. Save your notes. We'll try to finish this up next time. All right, any further questions or comments on this gory thing that we just left off on? All right, let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. Thank you. You are the victor. And when it's all said and done, you will rule and reign over this earth. And they will all pay homage to you. Whether they believe, whether they trust, whether they want to, they will. Because you are almighty. Father, thank you that you are the king. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.